Yes, indeed. The first cut is The Deepest by P.P. Arnold, sole survivor of the autobiography, documenting the musical highs and personal lows of P.P. Arnold's extraordinary life. This long-awaited memoir details the bigotry and abuse experienced by a young black woman growing up in the music industry on both sides of the Atlantic in the 60s and 70s, as well as the temptations and trappings that accompany fame and success. It is my great honour and pleasure to welcome on to the show this afternoon none other than P.P. Arnold. P.P., can I call you PP? Should I just genuflect and say it is an honor to have you on the show?
Yeah, sure. Hi there, Joe.
Good to have you. Good to have you with us today as well. It's an incredible book. I would never realize how ridiculously young you were when you were an Iquette. You were 16, 17?
17. I was 17 years old. I've just changed the audio here.
Okay.
I'm back.
Live radio.
I was trying to be clever, actually, and put on some headphones, so that was my bad. I'm sorry about that.
That's quite all right. No problem at all. I'm just happy that we got you back. So, your background, I suppose, I mean, is it, you could say it was that almost traditional route. Whereabouts are you from originally in the States, and was it via the gospel church route that has made so many wonderful artists and so many enriching and incredible voices?
Well, yes, I'm actually born in Los Angeles. My family are from Texas, East Texas. And yes, I was born into a family of gospel singers. So it's all about the church. It was all about the church and singing gospel as I grew up as a young girl.
And so when did you get spotted? There are millions of gospel singers around. I'm not meaning it derogatory, but obviously gospel is a huge thing and there are so many wonderful voices out there. So when did you first come across the radar that, you know, got you this into the showbiz aspect? And also, it's a leap, isn't it? I know there are several wonderful crossover artists that we've had, but, you know, from the devout life of a gospel artist, and many haven't gone across to the more secular business of soul and R&B is a bit of a stretch for some people.
Well, for me, it wasn't really my case because I was never I was never singing professionally as a gospel singer. I just sang, you know, normally. That was my life, singing in church and in the choir and everything. And I never had an ambition to be a professional singer at all. So it was just, I was in a situation. I was 17 years old and I was like in a quite an abusive teen marriage and I had two children and really my life was hell, to be honest. And I basically just said a prayer and asked God to show me a way out of the hell that I was in. And an hour later, the phone rang. And it was an ex-girlfriend of my brother's, Maxine Smith, and she and another singer, Gloria Scott, were calling me to help them get this gig as an Iquette. They were going to an audition, and another girl had let them down. So Maxine was basically just calling me out of desperation just to get anybody to go help them get the gig. And because she knew that I sang, but I wasn't a professional singer or anything. So anyway, she refused to take no for an answer and hung up the phone and turned up at my house about a half an hour later. And I lied and told my husband I was going shopping. And, you know, an hour later, I was in Argentina Turner's living room singing, dancing in the streets.
I'm just going out to do some shopping, you told your husband, and then you end up...
Yeah, that's right, because he wouldn't let me go. I mean, he wouldn't have let me go anywhere. I never did anything. So, yeah, so, and Maxine, you know, they just like kind of like, bam, they just turned up, so... I just sort of like went with it, you know, and so we did the audition and Tina goes, right, girls, you got the gig. And I go like, oh, no, not me. Not me. I just came to help them out. I got to go home. I'm going to be in big trouble. I should have been home 2 hours ago. And so Tina sort of said to me, you know, if you're going to get in trouble for nothing, why don't you ride up to Fresno with us and at least see the show? Now, Fresno was like, you know, hours from L.A. You know, it's like Northern California. So I ended up going with them up to Fresno to watch the show. And I came back home. I got in big trouble, as I had knew would happen. And this time when my husband hit me in the head, it was as if he knocked some sense into me. And I remembered the prayer. And I just sort of suddenly realized, wow, you know, this morning I didn't have a way out of my situation. And that evening, you know, I had an opportunity to be an ICAT that, you know, after a bit of to and fro with my family to see if they would help me and look after my babies and all of that, 24 hours after that, I was an ICAT.
And what was it like being an ICAT? Because we talk about the stresses and strains on modern artists, but when you think of artists like yourselves and James Brown, the hardest working man in show business, etc., I mean, the touring schedule was punishing, and also the demands that Ike made on, you know, on the band were also, I mean, it was a hard school.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's serious. You know, we went on 90-day tours across from the West Coast to the East Coast. You know, we were lucky if you had 3 or 4 days off in those 90 days. You know, you traveled around in old buses. You know, it wasn't modern travel or anything like that. And, yeah, it was tough. It was hard work. He was very strict. He held everything together with this sort of fining system that all those guys had. James Brown, all of them, they used it. So, like, if you sang out of tune, you got fined. If you sang out of tune too much, you got fired. You know, there was no, it was serious. You know, they had thick phone books with every singer and musician in the country. So, if you weren't on your game, somebody else could replace you very quickly.
And with the force of nature that is Tina Turner in the 60s, you know, in the mid-60s, and of course she goes on, if anybody hasn't seen sort of the Rolling on the River performances or the Nutbush City Limits performances, go see, because they are dynamite. I mean, what's it like to sing with, you know, you must want to up your game and go right then. I mean, it must be a brilliant performance to be there when everybody is so accomplished and you're all great musicians and singers and you're all pushing in the same direction.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely fantastic seeing Tina Turner for the first time that night when I lied and went to Fresno. That was amazing. That was like psychedelic experience, you know, seeing Tina Turner, as you say, a force of nature, you know, simply the best female entertainer even then, you know. So it's like, yeah, it was amazing, but I knew nothing. I never thought of myself. I wasn't thinking of myself as an artist or anything or show business thing. I was just thinking of to me, it was a job. It was a way that I felt that God had answered this prayer for me to help me sort of escape the marriage situation that I was in. And it was a way for me to support my 2 children. I had 2 children. I was 17 years old, so... And I had sort of like messed up my education. Now, there's no way that I could go back to school with 2 kids at that time. It was very, very difficult. So like it was just, you know, destiny, you know, answer to a prayer. And this is obviously my destiny.
There's a tendency amongst people to look back at the 60s with these rose-colored spectacles. And especially in the States with the Civil Rights Movement, everything that was going on, it wasn't an easy situation, was it?
Oh, no, it wasn't. And especially for me, it was a whole learning experience for me, because even though my family are from the South, I was born in L.A., and I hadn't really grown up in, like, the whole, you know, Jim Crow, racist, kind of segregated way of living in the South. So, yeah, I learned all about that. Being on the road with a black review in the 60s was not fun. You know what I mean? Well, it was fun. As soon as you hit the gig, it was fun because, you know, you were like, I cut my teeth working with the best of the best musicians, Tina Turner, the best female performer, Ike Turner, regardless of what he was personally. He was an amazing musician and band leader. And so, yeah, it was like just like really, really fantastic. But it was really tough in those days, you know. In the South, you couldn't, the Holiday Inn was the only like chain of hotels really that would let us stay there. We couldn't stay in certain hotels. You know, we couldn't stop on the road easily and just go to the loo just naturally without, you know, some racist kind of stuff going down. So, yeah, it was definitely, you know, some serious dudes.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, I suppose, because you came from L.A., and I suppose people from New York would say the same thing, you know, those are two big cities, two, if you like, relatively cosmopolitan in the 60s. But once you got off the trail, especially going down south, which is you know, which is sort of tongue-in-cheek when you think about Muscle Shoals and everything, the music that comes out of there, and yet it was a different country, a different situation.
Well, yeah, definitely, and I didn't know. I mean, the first time, my first experience of, like, really experiencing that, we were on the road and I needed to go to the loo, and so I kept bugging the bus driver to stop, and he wouldn't stop, you know, and I didn't understand why he would not stop. So then he finally stopped, and so he opened the door, so I go to use the restroom, as we call it in the States, you know.
Yeah.
The toilet. Yeah. And nobody else would get off the bus. So I just thought, oh, this is strange. Nobody else would get. So I just sort of pranced off into the petrol station inside, where I saw ladies and gents' toilets. And the guy, this little redneck, said to me, "Now, you know you can't come off in here. Your toilets are in the back, you know." I still didn't really understand what he was saying until I go around the back and I see this big sign that says for colored, right?
Yeah.
And I open up the door and it's just like horrible. It's just like just a hole in the ground with, you know, flies and
let's
awful.
People may be just finishing their lunches, Pee-Pee, so let's move from that. You let slip something just back then a minute ago, Pee-Pee, that I picked up on.
Yeah, it's awful. That's just how awful it was. Yeah. You know?
But
no, we couldn't just stop and go to the loo.
You see, you're using the word loo, and that's a bit of a British influence. And of course, in 66, you came to Britain and you learned the word loo for a start. But also, I mean, what was it like landing in, because it's swinging London, it's Carnaby Street, it's a whole different situation. And you know, coming over from the States, it must have been creatively.
It was big fun. It was amazing. It was just like, wow, for me. It was just, you know, as a young teenager, because I'm still a teenager, and I haven't had a teenage life. I haven't even had a chance to be a teenager. So, like, really, coming to England, you know, with right in the middle of the swinging 60s, you know, with all the great, you know, great fashion and music and culture, and, you know, everything was changing, you know, politically and everything. And it was like more integrated, more of an integrated cosmopolitan London.
Yeah.
More, you know, than back in the States, because everything was segregated back there. So it was different. And
you came across, and you originally came over to support the Rolling Stones, and a certain Mr. Jagger thought you can make it as a solo artist.
Well, you know, like, it's really funny how that, here we go. I tell you, destiny has played a big role in my life, because, you know, basically, Mick and I became friends. You know, he used to make me laugh. You know, this guy just just amazing, this little gangly white boy, you know, walking like a black man, talking like a black man, singing like a black man. And he just used to make me laugh. He's so funny because he's a lovely guy, really funny and everything. So we became friends, and then, you know, like, we kind of, like, had a, you know, we became an item for a short time.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, I had, like, Ike was not happy with me. Suddenly, I mean, I didn't know. I came to England. I've never hung out with white boys before, and then suddenly here was Jai, you know, really sort of, you know, here I was, you know, like, having a ball. Really, so for the first time in my life. And so, anyway, I was kind of fed up with Ike Turner and what was going on there. And I had planned on, like, leaving the Review when I came back to the States. And I just mentioned that to Mick. And through the grapevine, apparently Andrew Oldham, who was the Stones manager at the time and had a new independent record label, Immediate Records, wanted to sign me to the Immediate record label. As they didn't have any female artists signed, and Andrew was, like, really into, like, Phil Spector and the whole wall of sound and, you know, the girl group kind of thing. So, yeah, so they, like, Ian Stewart, who was Stone's road manager, you know, said to Andrew that he should check me out. And, you know, then they got Mick to, you know, present me with the opportunity, and yeah, so it was just like, wow.
Yeah, and we played the first Cut of the Deepest as an intro. But you weren't trying to do a war. I mean, how important was it to put your own stamp on this and not just be another Supremes, another Ronettes, or just another, you know?
Okay, for me, I'm gonna be totally honest here. You know, to me, you're talking to somebody who had nothing, no idea how to do any of this, put my stamp on this, that, or the other, or none of that. I just love to sing. And I obviously had a sound that people liked, but I had no confidence in my sound or no idea what I wanted to do. I just loved to sing. So when that song was presented to me, I liked the song. It was a beautiful song. It was as if Cat Stevens had written that song for me because it was my life, you know, a young girl, you know, in this sort of like all the stuff that I had been through was pretty deep. And so, yeah, so I just sang it. I just sang it in my own voice. And I like to, when I sing, to me, it's all about telling the story. So that story related to me. So that expression and diction and all of that, I knew, I don't know, I just kind of naturally had that in me and it came out like that.
That's absolutely, I mean, that is, as the saying goes, that soul. What was it like to have, because it was an incredibly quick turnaround, because one minute you're sitting there in Los Angeles with two children and a, you know, and shall we say, well, let's use some British understatement, shall we, you know, a marriage that isn't exactly inclusive, and then the next thing you know, you've got a massive international hit, you know, literally sort of 24, 48 months later.
Yeah, it was deep. It was really a true blessing, you know. It was just like a gift from the universe for me, you know, and it lifted me out of that situation that I was in. It gave me an opportunity to create a life for myself and my children. And, you know, when it happened, I didn't just, like, leave my children in L.A. I went back to my deal with my mom was that I would stay and I would see, because Mick said, it's going to take about 6 months if you stay to make the record, you know. So my mom had agreed to keep my kids for 6 months. And if it did nothing happen, I was going to come home. And if something happened, I was going to come home and get my kids and check out, you know, the opportunity fully. And that's what I did in that short period of time, those 6 months. I recorded First Cut and I had a hit, and I was able to go back home and bring my kids back to England with me. And that was difficult. You know, that was the, you know, I didn't, all I knew was that I wanted my children with me. I didn't realize how hard that would be, you know, being 6,000 miles away from home, you know, yeah. away from my family and friends and everything, you know, embarking on this solo career in this whole new world that I was living in. It's quite a story.
And if you go onto the social medias and the YouTube, you'll see a performance of you with one of the most influential. And I've had the opportunity to interview Kenny Jones, the Small Faces, and Steve Marriott, and that looks. I mean, they were fun, presumably.
Yeah, they were fun, and Steve Marriott was real fun. He was the leader for sure. You know, and Steve was the guys, all the boys were fun. They were all cheeky little EastEnders and everything. But my sort of like a professional and personal relationship was my connection with Steve, you know, as singers. We both loved singing together and working together, so... At that time, it was like at the height of the whole immediate record, you know, thing that was going on. And, you know, they had made me the first lady of immediate. And the Small Faces, they were my label mates. And we were like the same age, you know, we were all little. And we were all just like young and full of beans, you know. And like immediate had a lot going on for itself at that time, you know, because all the artists were like collaborating with one another, writing, producing, you know, just sort of working with each other, trying to kind of like have kind of like a kind of Motown kind of vibe in London, really. That's what we were like in the process of doing before, unfortunately, Immediate Records went bankrupt. And
you've managed to sort of to reinvent yourself, and obviously you've got an affection for the UK and England, and during sort of the 70s and into the 80s, and then you come out in the West End. Now, you know, that's for many people, they can't hack sort of musical theatre or appearing on stage in the West End. How were your thoughts about when you came to doing that then?
Well, that sort of like happened, you know, like after the Immediate folded, I had like connected with Barry Gibb, and Barry was producing lots of music with me for RSO Records. Their manager, the Bee Gees manager, Robert Stigwood, had RSO, and so Barry was influential with me signing to RSO and producing. We were both at a crossroads. Immediate it folded. I had no idea what I was going to do. He had split with his brothers for a while. We were at a crossroads and we met. He liked my version of To Love Somebody that I had recorded on my Kapunta album. And we became friends, and he was like, really, you know, we were just both into, you know, making music, making records, and he loved my voice, so he just started writing songs and stuff for me. And anyway, we did a lot of work that didn't really even get released until 2017 because of a lot of show business politics that went on. So anyway, after the thing with my whole time with RSO was not happening because Robert Stigwood did not believe in me as an artist, and he was not supporting any of the music that I was recording, not only the music that I was recording with Barry, but he also wasn't supporting the music that that Eric Clapton had produced. So I was just kind of hanging in limbo when the first musical, Catch My Soul, Jack Good, who was an English producer, you know, impresario guy who had done lots of TV shows in England. And I knew him from the shows that he had did in America. He had Shindig. Was it Shindig?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I have to wash my head because I have so many things in my head. Okay. So Robert was friends with Jack, and so they put me in. Robert got me lead role in a version of rock version of Othello, Catch My Soul, which I did with E.J. Proby and Lance McGault and some other British, you know, very British actor.
Yeah.
So it was different. It was different. But you know, I like doing things that are different, and I really quite like doing the theater thing. But the situation that I was working with, T.J. Proby and I did not get along.
Right. And, okay.
Yeah. So like I was like, what of my character was opposite his character. So I had to work with him a lot. It was very difficult. Anyway, it was okay. It was my first experience of the theater. And I liked it. It was really good. But to be honest, after the show was going, after a while, for me, it gets boring because I'm a soul singer and I like saying,
yeah, indeed. We're losing you a little bit. Just tell us, because the book pulls no punches, and it's incredibly brave for you to go to when you went through, both sort of professionally and personally, and some of the abuse you suffered. I mean, it's, you know, it's a good read, but it's a hard read in places.
Yeah, it's a hard read. You know, life is hard. You know, and so my book is like document my life, my personal life, and my professional life, both of which have been challenging for me. You know, they were both challenging, and it's a hard read, but it's an honest read. I when I decided to write my book, which I did, the book has been sitting on the shelf for a long time. I wasn't able to connect with the right publishers and things, and people were at the time, they were kind of basically interested in knowing about the people, you know, who were in my book, you know, the high profile characters that are part of my life. You know, so, and for me, it was really important that my story as a woman, as a young Black woman from Watts, and my journey in the music industry through Argentina, through all the 60s, and the many, many artists and people that I've collaborated with, you know, it was really important to me that the book be about me.
Yeah, well, the book is called Soul Survivor, the autobiography. Unfortunately, we're losing you a bit, and also we've been on the air for about 35 minutes talking about this, believe it or not. It's by P.P. Arnold. P.P., if people want to find you, just quickly, where can they find you online?
You can find me online. You can go to pparnold.com. You can go to P.P. Arnold Instagram, P.P. Arnold Facebook, P.P. Arnold YouTube.
I think there's enough. They can find you anywhere on the social networks. The book is called Soul Survivor, the autobiography. It's by P.P. Arnold. P.P., it's been an absolute honor to speak to you today.
Oh, Giles, it's really nice to speak to you.